Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, Grace Wan. Will progressives and moderates feud as the country burns, or will they unite to defeat President Trump and usher in a new era of reform? This is the central question posed by author E.J. Dionne in his recently published book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. We're thrilled to have E.J. Dionne joining us by phone tonight. He's an accomplished scholar and author, a columnist for The Washington Post, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown, and a visiting professor at Harvard. He is also the co-author of the recent New York Times bestseller, One Nation After Trump, as well as several other influential and bestselling books. I shall also add that E.J. Dionne will be appearing locally this Thursday at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco and at the Hillside Club in Berkeley. You can find the details of those appearances on our City Visions page at kalw.org. But for now, let us welcome E.J. Dionne.
It's so good to be with you. Thank you.
Thanks. We're so happy to have you here. And we're inviting our listeners to join our conversation. Next week is Super Tuesday. It's California's primary. How will you be voting? And will progressives or moderates prevail? And how can those two sides come together after what is likely to be a very bruising primary season? But before we get into all of that, I would say, EJ, reading your book was both intellectually satisfying and emotionally soothing because it felt like being with your Democratic Party family therapist in how you are encouraging us to the sides to get together, the progressives and the moderates. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you.
So here we are.
I want to take that down and put it on the paperback. Thank you.
I'll blurb that for you. Democratic Family Therapy with E.J. Dionne. So here we are. We're 1 week away from Super Tuesday. Bernie Sanders is in the lead, and no one seems to be dropping out. There's a sort of existential dread in some aspects of the Democratic Party. Did you expect that?
I wrote the book because I was worried about the fractiousness in the party at a time when it can least afford it because, in my view, I suspect in the view of a lot of people listening to us, President Trump poses a real threat in his first term and an unleashed President Trump in his second term would be very dangerous for us. So if there's ever a time when people need to figure out how to get along on the broad progressive side of politics, this is that time. I don't think I would have predicted exactly where this stands right now, but I'm not surprised that you're really seeing a kind of 50-50 split in the party if you add up all the votes. Maybe a little that Sanders has an overwhelming lead because all his opponents, he's got so many opponents on the other side of the party. I wrote in a column this morning that Sanders is beating all his opponents because all his opponents are beating each other. And so I think that is the dynamic right now, and no one seems to want to give way. What I am worried about is that what progressives and moderates are going to exaggerate their differences in this period rather than focus on how much they have in common. I appreciated your use of the family counselor idea because I have that in the book. And, of course, when you make an argument that, hey, wait a minute, you guys should listen to each other, you're like the family counselor who gets thrown out the door and people go back to their favorite arguments. But on a whole series of issues, I think they're closer than they think. They are all for universal coverage. One side wants to do it through the public option, which only a few years ago couldn't get through a Democratic Congress. The other side wants to do it with single payer. I was struck that AOC recently said that, well, yes, she's for single payer, but that's a bargaining position. If we end up with a public option, would that be so bad? And I thought, maybe AOC has read my book, the author said, hopefully, because that's the kind of argument I make. Similarly, on free college, whether you move to free public college immediately or go through a halfway point like President Obama's idea for 2 years of free community college, you are moving in the right direction. You're all moving in the same direction. Same on the Green New Deal. And so what I'm hoping is that progressives and moderates realize that in the long history of progressive reform in the country, there has always been a kind of governing center that needed the pressure from more progressive parts of the movement. And just to close on this, I talk about FDR's relationship with Sidney Hillman. Sidney Hillman was head of the CIO's political operation. And the CIO did two things. On the one hand, it pressured Roosevelt hard to move in a progressive direction, and sometimes Roosevelt welcomed the pressure. It made him easier for him to move. But when it came down to it, they would support Roosevelt against his conservative adversaries. That is a functional relationship between moderation or moderate progressivism and the left, and I'm hoping to encourage that kind of functional relationship on the broad progressive side of politics.
Yeah, and you're saying in your book that, you know, there's some people in the party, Democratic Party, who are saying we need really big ideas to get people to the voting booth, to change our country, so we need to transform. And then there's another part of the party that's saying, gosh, so much bad has happened in the last 4 years. We need to restore what we had before Trump was in office. So can you talk a little bit about that, that this should we be looking at transformation or restoration or both?
Well, my answer is both. I think it's a false choice because I think in order to move forward, we have to restore democratic norms that have been lost under Trump. We have to restore a more normal way of doing democracy's business. We have to restore decent treatment of immigrants and refugees. I mean, there was criticism of President Obama's deportation, some of it justified, but you didn't have the kind of thing happening to children at the borders that you have under President Trump. So there's a lot of restoration to do. But I think the people who argue for transformation have a point. We have to deal with the underlying problems that help lead to Donald Trump's election and that are causing an awful lot of economic pain for a lot of people in the country. We have to deal with the very substantial regional inequalities and also the inequalities even within wealthy places. In fact, in wealthy places, as you know, out there in San Francisco, the inequalities can be very large within metro areas. Mm-hmm. And so we've got to start dealing with some of those problems. What I argue to try to bring together the restoration and transformation ideas is that for an awful lot of people, both in the center of the Democratic Party on the left and those refugees from the Republican Party, what they want to do is restore progress. I am taken, you know, Trump's slogan was "Make America Great Again," but there was another powerful "Again" slogan, and that was John F. Kennedy's "Let's get the country moving again." And I think that's what an awful lot of people across the progressive spectrum want to do.
Yeah. And, you know, when we talk about progressives and moderates, particularly in a place like the Bay Area, which is fairly liberal, I think we can say that.
I think that's fair.
It's a little unclear sometimes what a moderate is, because sometimes you could be you feel like you're a Democrat and a moderate, but be treated like you're a John Birch Republican when your ideas don't meld with maybe what's on the farther on the left. So can you talk a little bit about how you define those terms in your book?
Right. I think moderate is by far the trickier term to define because there are an awful lot of people who would find themselves in the middle of this political spectrum but disagree on everything. You know, just imagine two voters, one of whom is pro-choice on abortion but very anti-labor, say. The other is very pro-labor but pro-life or anti-choice. On abortion, they're both in the center, but they don't agree on anything. What I think of when I use moderate is partly a set of dispositional virtues. There's a political scientist called Aurelien Creutzfeldt who talks about the virtues of moderation, that it promotes pluralism, a propensity to seek conciliation and find balance, an assumption that there is not only one single correct idea, and acknowledging that most political and social issues involve big trade-offs. This kind of moderate disposition, I think, is something the country would welcome after the extremism of the Trump years. The other thing about moderates is they tend to want change to happen step by step. Progressives, in my usage, are more what you think of as people more on the left of the Democratic Party. They want, as Elizabeth Warren says, big structural change. They're very critical, as Bernie Sanders has been, of the workings of our current version of capitalism. And they want change very quickly. What I argue brings them together is an idea that actually comes from a democratic socialist, the late Michael Harrington, one of my heroes, actually. He wrote the book The Other America, which helped back in the 60s, which helped kick off the pressure for a poverty program, because he wrote about the poor that we were ignoring in the country. But Mike had this great term, visionary gradualism. And I don't expect people will go marching in the streets for visionary gradualism,
yeah.
But I think as a concept it's the right idea because it brings together what I think the two sides are right about. The left is absolutely right that you need a vision for fundamental reform. There are big problems in the country that we have to deal with, and there's an urgency to begin dealing with them. We have to, for example, cover all Americans with affordable, decent health insurance. It's crazy. We are the only wealthy country in the world that doesn't do that. Whether you get there, however, through a public option or Medicare for all, that's a reasonable debate. We just have to start moving. So that's the visionary part. You can go through a long list of issues where we need that kind of change. The gradualism part is that we often achieve big change step by step. And the two examples I talk about are the Social Security program, which was nowhere near as broad when it was first enacted under FDR than it became over the next 20 years. But it set in place a new system that the country was not going to let anybody take away from them, and the country insisted on broadening it. The other example I use are the civil rights bills. That in the 1950s, after Brown v. Board, there were two very weak civil rights bills that were passed, but they opened the way for the great Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act of 1965. So you can be in favor of substantial reform, which I am in our country, but accept that it may take you a little bit longer than just doing it all at once. And God knows, with what's happening in Congress right now, it's going to take a lot to begin this process of reform.
Well, is there a candidate now who you think encapsulates that idea of visionary gradualism and is somebody who the party will coalesce around?
No, at this point, I've got to say I am an absolutely typical voter. I'm not always a typical voter in an election. There are sometimes when I'm absolutely clear, every once in a while, I'm for somebody who has absolutely no chance of winning. In this campaign, I see some virtues in everyone and find myself attracted to different aspects of the candidates, but I don't really have one yet. I like some of Elizabeth Warren's policy proposals. I write quite a bit about her in the book. For example, I think her wealth tax is a very important suggestion because given how wealth is concentrated in the country now, we need to begin to find ways of taxing it. Now, whether you do it through her wealth tax or, for example, through higher capital gains taxes or some other things, you know, we can debate about that. But she has put this on the table, and I think it's something we need to discuss. I like Pete Buttigieg's way of welcoming in people into the coalition. One of my favorite lines on politics, which I cite in the book, is Mark Shields, the great political commentator, who said that there are people in politics, as in religion, who seek converts and those who hunt for heretics. And boy, this is a moment in our history when our side needs to seek converts. And while I have some disagreements with Bernie Sanders, I'm glad he's opened up space in a political conversation that had been really restricted by the Reagan, by the Reagan consensus. And lastly, I've known Joe Biden a long time. I think he's a very decent man, and we're going to see what happens in South Carolina.
That should be interesting. Well, let's talk a little bit about Bernie Sanders. You know, there's that the S word, socialism, and how that will play in this primary, in a general election. And I was thinking about a quote from Charlotte Alter, who's a journalist. And
yes.
When she talks about socialism, she says, boomers, when they talk about socialism, think of gulags, lines, and bad shoes. And millennials think about Sweden, free healthcare, and free education. How is socialism, that term, that idea, going to play in the primary? And how should we think about it in the context of, you know, these sides coming together?
Well, she's a very smart woman, and she is exactly right about that. When young people do not think of the Soviet Union, they do not think of the Gulag. That is way long ago. And in their experience, socialism is Sweden or Denmark. And by the way, the studies show the people of Denmark are the happiest people in the world, so their version of socialism doesn't seem to be too oppressive. I think politically, by the way, I also think it's no accident that younger people are more attracted to socialism and less embracing of capitalism, because they entered the economy after the great crash of 2008. And if they were college-bound, they went to college at a moment when public universities were jacking up their tuitions because states were slashing their public education budgets for higher ed. If they were going into the workforce, they found it very difficult to find the sorts of jobs their parents or grandparents had in the blue-collar world that paid a decent wage, a living wage, something you could have a decent life on. So I think young people are inherently more skeptical of our system than older people are. I think politically the problem with the S-word, with socialism, is what it might do to a candidate with older voters. I mean, I do worry about that with Bernie. Bernie is really more, as all these other countries are, is really more of a social democrat than a democratic socialist. And I think of myself as a social democrat, somebody who accepts the benefits of markets, that we will have a market system of one kind or another. But I don't think the market is God. I think that the market needs regulation. I think we need redistribution. Sweden and Denmark and Norway have very successful capitalist economies, but within sensible constraints. And that's really where Bernie is. When he speaks about socialism, he talks a lot more about the New Deal than he does about anything else. But I think the S word does push away some older voters. Obviously, Republicans he will never get. But I worry that there are some people in the middle who might be turned off by it.
Well, what did you make of his comments last night on 60 Minutes that Fidel Castro was not all bad, and the reaction he's getting in Florida for that?
You do not do well in Florida by saying anything good about Fidel Castro. Even younger Cubans who are much more open to a policy of engagement with Cuba very much want to, and who actually supported President Obama and his moves in that direction, are not sympathetic to Castro and his regime. And I think for Sanders, the problem is not, it is possible to talk about Castro if you're not a politician and say, this is a deeply oppressive regime that jails political opponents. Here are the social gains that have been made that a more democratic regime might want to preserve. I could see a conversation like that. It does not help Bernie Sanders to be saying anything positive about Fidel Castro at this moment.
Well, it seems one of the difficulties is that the arguments are somewhat nuanced, and nuance is not something that plays really well in elections.
That's true, although I have watched politicians. Obama was quite good at this. Politicians who are kind of candid with people on complicated issues. And as a friend of mine I was talking to today, who's been active in a lot of campaigns, said, if a politician explains their values when they are talking about an issue, for example, immigration is actually a complicated issue to deal with, because we need to figure out how many people are we going to let in at any given time, how are we going to make those judgments. Most Americans don't favor open borders, but most Americans are also opposed to the kind of really repressive policies that President Trump has pursued. And on immigration, I think if somebody says, look, people should obey the law, I'm not in favor of open borders, I am in favor of taking all the people who live here, who are undocumented, who work every day, who pay taxes, in fact, and don't get anything back for it in terms of Social Security or anything. I want to give them a path to citizenship if they meet certain requirements, and I surely want to treat kids and refugees better. If they explain that, it's not a simplistic build a wall, but I think a lot of people nod their heads and say, yeah, that's basically what I feel about immigration. So I know nuance has a bad reputation in politics, and Trump has surely shown that saying a few simple things can at least win you by a bare majority, a majority in the Electoral College. But I think a lot of voters of all types are open to more complicated arguments.
That, and maybe we can get it on a hat. It will work for us. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Grace Wan, and tonight we're in conversation with E.J. Dionne about his recent book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. How are you voting in Tuesday's primary? Do you have a question for E.J. about how progressives and moderates can come together? Give us a call at 866-798-TALK. Again, that's 866-798-8255. You can email us at cityvisions@kalw.org or tweet us at cityvisionskalw. So, E.J., we've been talking about Bernie and socialism, but I'd like to kind of take the conversation to the other side. We have two billionaires running in the Democratic primary. We have a putative billionaire in office. What does it say about our country that, and particularly about the Democratic Party, that billionaires are running for office? That doesn't feel very progressive, even if they seem to espouse a progressive platform.
No, it's actually, it is very disturbing, and it shows what a mess our campaign finance system is after Citizens United, the notion that people can just come in and really buy their way into a campaign, unlike other candidates who have to work hard and usually hold some kind of public office before they do it. I will, Mike Bloomberg had a horrible debate the other night, and particularly the first half, and Elizabeth Warren really took him apart. I do think he's had one great line in this campaign when somebody said, you know, there are two billionaires in this election, and Bloomberg said, who's the other one? referring to Trump and questions about his wealth. But yeah, no, that is disturbing, and I think it is going to, even though Bloomberg is clearly, his ads are effective, they are everywhere. No one has ever done anything like Bloomberg is doing in the Super Tuesday primary, so he's getting something for all that money. But I think there is a pulling back from him because people say, should someone be able to come into a race and do this? And, you know, the pushback comes not only from Bernie and Elizabeth Warren, it's coming from, you know, from Klobuchar and Biden, Amy Klobuchar and Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg all. And I think that has some resonance with Democrats.
But do you think that the Democratic, I guess the National Committee, and letting Bloomberg participate in that race is allowing that to happen and is actually buying into the ability of one single person to get himself onto the debate stage?
Well, I actually was of the view, and I think a number of the candidates said this themselves, that even though they are trying to beat Bloomberg, if you don't have the accountability of the debate, all you've got is the ads. And so a lot of people have used Wizard of Oz metaphors that he really had to come from behind the curtain and join the debate. And it was so far the most harmful thing that's happened to his campaign. I think the debate rules have been very complicated, and I think there are all kinds of ways to criticize them. I don't know how you properly adjudicate a debate at the earlier stage when you had like 20 candidates. You could have probably hired a stadium to have a Democratic debate, not for the crowd, but for the candidates. But, you know, the fact that they changed them, in Bloomberg's case, didn't change them earlier when Kamala Harris and Cory Booker didn't make a cutoff, that troubled a lot of people, you know, to see that comparison. I would have rather seen Booker and Harris in those debates myself.
Sure, yeah. Do you feel that, I mean, so there was an article today in the paper about Tom Steyer, you know, possibly buying votes in South Carolina or at least contributing heavily to that. Is he doing the same thing as Bloomberg? And he's our local San Francisco guy.
Yeah, I mean, it's effectively the same thing. I was watching Rachel Maddow earlier tonight, and she had all of the non-Steyer candidates spending in Nevada, and it was somewhere in the range of $1 to $2 million. And then she had to change the scale of the chart when she added Steyer, because he was at 14 million, 14.8 million, something like that. So it's kind of crazy what he's spending. I think Personally, I think there are better uses he could put to this this money to. He has given money to a variety of causes usefully. I'm not sure spending all this money on his presidential campaign is the best political use of his money, but it's not my money.
Well, why, EJ, why do you think that, just to stay on this for one more second, why do billionaires have such an appeal? Like, why are people even looking at these two candidates, you know, who have business backgrounds? I mean, Mayor Bloomberg was mayor of New York, but Tom Steyer has never been an elected official. Why are they compelling?
Well, I mean, Steyer hasn't done very well yet. I mean, he came in fifth in Nevada with all that spending, and he didn't do very well in Iowa or New Hampshire. He is doing better in South Carolina, and he has a history with the African-American community of supporting various programs and causes, which seem to be helping him a little bit in South Carolina. I wonder if he will spend just enough to be a spoiler to somebody but not be able to emerge himself. So I don't think there's any natural attraction to billionaires. I think in Trump's case, he, A, had all the notoriety that came from his television show, and B, tapped into a very angry wing of the Republican Party, which has become now the largest wing of the Republican Party. And he had a situation where all the other alternative candidates battled each other to the death, and he emerged from that. In Bloomberg's case, he didn't start out with all this support. He has gained all this support by virtue of spending hundreds of millions of dollars on advertising. And you can sell a lot of stuff if you have hundreds of millions of dollars of advertising. You know, and his message is very strongly anti-Trump, which appeals to virtually every wing of the Democratic Party. So it's been working for him up to the point of that debate, where we're really going to find out what the limits of this are. I think the real question for Bloomberg is, if Joe Biden actually succeeds in South Carolina, does he become the candidate of the non-Bernie wing of the party, and does this push back Bloomberg, or does Bloomberg's money simply have the effect of splitting the non-Bernie vote and helping Bernie win some more primaries?
That's fascinating. Well, you mentioned the Republican Party and that angry wing of it. And in your book, you kind of talk about the change or the transformation of the Republican Party, and it's not just Trumpism. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think it's very – there's a tendency to say, well, Trump engaged in a hostile takeover of the Republican Party. Well, yeah, a lot of Republican politicians who ran against him weren't happy about it. But there were changes going on in the Republican Party before Trump that paved the way for him. And, you know, when Republicans I've talked to complain about Trump, you know, becoming president, I remember John F. Kennedy's great line from his inaugural address where he said, he who rides to power on the back of the tiger ends up inside. Mm-hmm. These Republicans welcomed Trump's support. They didn't challenge him very hard when he said that President Obama wasn't born in the United States. The shift against immigration in the Republican Party happened under President George W. Bush, not because Bush was for it, but the Republicans in Congress voted down Bush's immigration reform program. I think that was the beginning, in some ways, of the Trump movement. Sarah Palin's candidacy for vice president was another step toward building the Trump movement. And while Trump runs as a populist on basic economic issues, whether it's taxes or slashing regulation of the environment or business and labor regulations, he is very much in the mainstream of the Republican Party and appointing all these very, very conservative judges. And so Trump, so I think you're dealing with two overlapping problems. One is Trumpism and the particular prejudices and the sort of increasingly authoritarian nature of it on the one side, but you're also talking about a radicalization of a Republican Party that once upon a time actually was willing to grapple with public problems. I like to point out that President Nixon's health care proposal was way to the left of Obamacare. You know, Nixon signed the creation of the EPA, of the Consumer Product Safety Commission. I mean, the Republican Party, once upon a time, has always had a big conservative wing, but it was willing to do things. Eisenhower signed the National Defense Education Act, which gave the loans that helped me go to college. The Republican Party has kind of abandoned public action to a very large degree at this point. So it's both aspects of Republicanism that I think has created a radicalization that means that most people who would have been a moderate or even liberal Republicans, they used to have those, especially in California, people like the late Senator Kuchel, the people who were once moderate or liberal Republicans are now inside the Democratic Party, which is another reason why Democrats have so many fights, because most of the big fights happen within the Democratic sphere.
I want to return to that, but this is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Grace Wan, and tonight we're in conversation with E.J. Dionne about his book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. Please give us a call if you'd like to join our conversation at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. Or you can email us now at cityvisions@KALW.org or tweet at cityvisionsKALW. We were talking about how the Republican Party has really steered far to the right, and the refugees from that center, that Rockefeller Republican, has come to the Democratic Party for lack of not having a party. Are you saying that bipartisanship is dead?
I think for the time being it is. By the way, I was just thinking that I may be the first person in decades to mention Senator Tom Kuchel on your air, which either means I love history or I'm getting old or both.
I think you love history and have a capacious mind.
I would like to return to a time when it was possible for people to work across the aisle. One of the great examples of that that has created a program that has helped end hunger in the United States were Bob Dole, very conservative, and George McGovern, very progressive, who worked together to create the food stamp program, the SNAP program as we know it today. Ted Kennedy and Orrin Hatch worked together on a number of proposals, including creating the state children's health care plan, which gave health insurance to a lot of kids. But right now, that sort of bipartisan action is just not on the table because the Republican Party has become so radical. And it's not just the politicians. If you look at the makeup of the Republican Party with the flight of all these moderates, two-thirds or more of Republicans are now conservative, including a whole lot of people who think of themselves as very conservative. People who cheered when Rush Limbaugh got the Medal of Honor the other night. The Democratic Party is a mixed party still. It's more liberal than it used to be because younger Americans are more liberal. They're the most liberal generation in the country, progressive generation. But Democrats are still half liberal and half either moderate or conservative. So one is a broad coalition party. The other is a right-wing party. And that does not make for easy bipartisanship. I would like to see this version of Republicanism defeated. I lay out what I think would be a constructive form of conservatism in the country. I'm asking all my conservative friends to read it to see if they think I'm describing conservatism or just a palatable kind of liberalism for them. But I think I lay out some fairly conservative principles, but that are not extreme of the sort we're seeing now.
Well, do you feel that perhaps those in the middle are creating a much stronger independent voter coalition? And is that growing? Has that grown bigger since 2016 and 2018?
You know, I go with all the political scientists who say that the label independent is misleading because there are a lot of people who like to call themselves independent because they don't like parties or they don't want to be partisans or they want to look open-minded. But when you look at their actual voting behavior, they vote 90% of the time for one party or the other. The number of authentic independents is much older. I was talking to a pollster who said it was a focus group of independents and they had not checked their voting history. And there were a couple of people there, and she asked them, when did you last vote for a Democrat? And the two independents who said they were independents said, gee, we've never voted for a Democrat before. I think there are people who have mixed political views who run crosswise to the parties. I think There are, you know, libertarians who feel uncomfortable with aspects of both parties. And similarly, I think there are people on the left who think both parties are too, you know, too controlled by capitalism. But I think the vast, for the vast majority of people, they do fall into one party or the other. I think the difficulty is in a country, if we had a multi-party system, for example, it's very possible that, say, a Biden or a Buttigieg would be in a center-left party. Bernie would be in a left party. I'm not sure which. Warren would be somewhere between those two. The advantage of a coalition party is voters know ahead of time what coalition they are electing. So I think there's a defense of the two-party system, but it's very hard to run a two-party system in a constructive way with the kind of polarization we have right now.
Well, in talking about that polarization, you had a in your book, and also you had a piece in The Atlantic about the politics of dignity, and your plea that people that politicians really embrace dignity as they come up with their ideas and platforms and what they're saying to voters. Can you speak a little bit about that?
Yeah, in the book, in the first chapter of my book, as you know, I talk about the 2018 elections, and I talk about travel I did during 2018, where I met a lot of fascinating candidates at all ends of the party, from Stacey Abrams to Ayanna Pressley to Abigail Spanberger. And one of my stops was in Ohio, and I was sitting in the back of a car where Senator Sherrod Brown was headed toward the Democratic State Convention. And I basically asked him what his campaign was about, and he said it was about the dignity of work and the fact that so many Americans feel that their work goes disrespected, that they are not treated with equal dignity in the society. And I think dignity is such a central idea and ought to be the governing idea both in our politics. We need a politics of dignity, and we need an economics of dignity. I talk about some ideas from an economist called Gene Sperling, who says that, you know, dignity is about having some control over the work you do and not being disrespected or dominated at work. Dignity is about being able to live a productive family life where you can fulfill your responsibilities without being constantly tugged away, often by the need to hold two jobs. And dignity is about having a sense of fulfillment and a sense that you can advance in life, in your career, in your economic position. And I think dignity is an idea that can bring together groups that are often seen as divided. When I think of some of the Trump voters in the parts of the country, old factory towns that have been flattened by globalization and trade and technological change, the problems they face are very similar to problems, economic problems, faced by African Americans in inner cities. There's a great sociologist called William J. Wilson, who wrote a book called When Work Disappears. And he was talking about the costs of deindustrialization in the inner city. Those problems have now migrated to a lot of other communities that are predominantly white. And I think that we can have a more sophisticated conversation across racial lines that's also unifying. We have to acknowledge that African Americans face burdens and forms of discrimination and a history that goes back to slavery that is qualitatively different than the experience of white people, including all of us who descend from immigrants. On the other hand, the African American worker and the white worker have a great deal in common in their struggle. And I talk about Robert Kennedy's 1968 campaign, where he created a sense of trust on both sides of this divide at another moment when we were very racially divided. And I remind people that the Great Civil Rights March in 1963, the slogan was jobs and justice. It linked the economic wherewithal to exercise your rights with the rights themselves.
That's lovely. I think that those are parts of the platform that you don't hear as much about right now, but I think that is an important piece that we need to keep thinking about. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. I'm Grace Wan, and tonight we're in conversation with E.J. Dionne about his book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. You can join the conversation by dialing 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. We have a comment from Art in San Francisco, who asks, do you have any specific ideas as to how to bring moderates and progressives together in a way that would allow them to deliberately engage in a cooperative process in which they would try to find common ground? For example, how about a town hall meeting where articulate and passionate moderates and progressives could identify their differences yet try to find a common ground? What do you think about that, E.J. Dionne? Town halls?
Well, you know, I took a small crack at it with this book where my publisher helped me organize a Code Red book club on Twitter where we I invited people on my Twitter feed to fill out forms where they sort of identified themselves. They picked a side, moderate or progressive. Moderate or progressive. Sorry, I dropped something. And are we still connected?
We are still here.
Oh,
we
good.
Are very
Thank
much
you.
Here.
You know, where they identified themselves. And we put together 50 people who were moderate and 50 people who were progressive and had a really delightful conversation, you know, on Twitter. Now, there are other ways to do that. I've thought about trying to organize book club conversations along these lines, but I think you're actually seeing it in practice. You know, one of the arguments, two of the people I visited with, I mentioned earlier during the campaign, who got elected to Congress 2018, one was Ayanna Pressley, the other was Abigail Spanberger. Pressley, African-American city council member in Boston, who won a primary with the support of AOC against an incumbent Democrat, you know, very impressive young progressive voice. And the other is Abigail Spanberger, a moderate former CIA agent, and a very impressive, more moderate Democratic voice. And what I argued is each needed the other because, you know, Pressley needed Spanberger to win in a more conservative district in order to exercise power as part of a Democratic majority. Spanberger needed the activism that the left often provides Democratic campaigns. And rarely do you have a book event that where one of the theories in your book is ratified, but I was talking about these two campaigns, and a man stood up at a bookstore here in Washington and said, I am way more progressive than Abigail Spanberger, and I worked my heart out for her. Mm. And I think as a practical level, when you get below the presidential level, you see a lot of cooperation between progressives and moderates. You've seen a lot of that in the anti-Trump movement, especially in smaller towns where progressives and Democrats are a minority. And so people tend to want to find allies rather than hunt heretics. I think sometimes when you throw lots and lots of relatively liberal people together, they always seem to fight each other because there is no real opponent to fight against.
Yeah, that's, I mean, I think that's very true.
I may have just described San Francisco.
Yes, I was going to say, well, and that leads me to my next question about Nancy Pelosi, you know, our representative and Speaker of the House. You know, before 2018, she was quoted as saying, win, baby, win, when she was talking about those congressional races. She didn't care how you did it, as long as you won. And now you're seeing on Twitter, you know, vote blue no matter who. So there seems to be an effort to try to get the party, the disparate ends of it, to come together to make sure that no matter what happens in November, everybody votes blue no matter who. Do you think that's going to work? And do you think Pelosi's been a good leader in that way?
Yeah, I mean, I think Pelosi is a very effective leader. It's funny that quote that's in the book came when she was asked, I was at an event where she was asked about all the people who said they would vote against her for speaker. And basically she said she didn't care what they said, just win, baby, she said. And, you know, and I think she figured, and she was right, that she would figure out a way to get to be speaker again, no matter what they were saying on the campaign trail.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Is somebody like Abigail Spanberger, who's representing a district in Northern Virginia, and she's a former CIA agent, if Bernie was at the top of the ticket, would she have to do the same disavowal, do you think?
Yes, I think that district is, well, there are a lot of members of the House like Spanberger. I haven't talked to her about this, so I don't know this for a fact, but I'm pretty sure it's true. The Washington Post had a good piece on this. They are very nervous about having Bernie on the ticket because, you know, the person she beat was a Tea Party Republican who had defeated Eric Cantor, the former Republican leader in a primary. It's a very conservative district that she won, if I recall right, by about 7,000 votes. So she doesn't have a lot of margin in that district. So I think that is one of the conversations you're going to hear a lot on the campaign trail in the next couple of weeks, which is what would the effect of Bernie be? And, you know, at the moment, he actually does pretty well in one-on-one matchups with Trump. A lot of Bernie supporters say, what evidence do you have that he is as dangerous as you think he is? But most of these moderate members know their districts pretty well, and they seem to be worried.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting. So there's a lot of conversation that there's not a front runner at this point in the primary, but we're still early on. And it reminds me a little bit about where the Republicans were when Trump became their nominee. They were kind of all over the place. And, you know, Jeb Bush feels like our Biden. And, you know, there's some analogies to be made. But people are talking about a brokered convention. How do you think that that's going to play out? And how do the precepts of your book, if we could bring your book to that convention, how would you broker that as our Democratic Party family therapist?
Well, you know, when you talked about the person who wrote in to you asking the question, you know, how can people work out these differences, I have been thinking that a brokered convention could actually be useful and not simply a mess. Most people look at a brokered convention as a mess. If Bernie came in with a plurality, his supporters would say, why don't you nominate Bernie? But if he doesn't have a majority of the delegates, it means he doesn't command a majority of the party. I think a brokered convention could actually provide a chance for the kind of debate and you know, an effort to reach agreement that would be like a big, complicated town hall. Now, I think there were a lot of your listeners who are hearing that and saying, this guy is crazy, because to imagine that a televised convention in this age could be such a thing is kind of crazy. And that may well be true. But I do think there, you know, you see it working out. You certainly see it in the Congress, where there is a left wing of the Democratic caucus and a much more moderate wing. And there is some scratchiness and there's some you know, upset now and again, and partly because of Pelosi's leadership, but partly because this whole group of Democrats wants to pass a lot of stuff. I mean, they have passed a lot of things that have died in the Senate. There'd be a pretty good program to pass if a Democrat were president, just out of all those bills. And they know they have a collective interest in holding their majority. And you don't have quite that kind of discipline in a presidential race. But I wonder sometimes if a brokered convention would create a framework in which people would fight out these differences. And I think there are good models and bad models. The worst model was the 1924 Democratic Convention, when the party was utterly split between predominantly urban Catholics and rural Protestants. It went 102 ballots, and the Democratic nominee got exactly 28% of the vote in the election. That's the bad model for a brokered convention. On the other hand, Abraham Lincoln won on the third ballot, and so did FDR. And those were pretty good choices. We could do a lot worse.
So if we show the messy laundry, that's okay, because that would be getting to the right solution.
Well, yeah, I think because people would have to work things out. FDR might have been the fourth ballot, but it was a multiple ballot convention that gave us FDR and Lincoln. And Lincoln is a good case in point, because he represented the center of gravity in the Republican Party at that time. He was seen as sort of the centrist compared to this, you know, a much more fiery anti-slavery wing and a wing that was hardly anti-slavery at all, and he was the person who could pull these wings together. That's the kind of nominee they need.
Well, what in talking about, you know, this progressive moderate matrix, what does it say about the party that all the candidates are white?
You could also say, what does it say about the party that when this whole thing started, there was a Latino candidate, a prominent African-American male senator, and a prominent African-American female senator. I actually think what happened in this primary is that Joe Biden's presence in the race and the fact that he rallied support from, you know, almost the entirety, really, of the older African-American population, not necessarily younger African-Americans. I think he sort of blocked the space that either Senator Harris or Senator Booker needed to emerge. So I think there was a structural problem in this particular race because of where African-American voters ended up with Joe Biden. So it is, you know, for a party that depends so much on the African-American vote, you can argue that this is a problem and a challenge. But I think there are some specific explanations to this year, and Democrats are still the only party that has elected an African-American as president of the United States.
If Biden doesn't hold South Carolina, what does that say about the African-American vote?
Well, I think if he doesn't hold, I mean, I think when you look at Biden's decline, or some would say collapse up to this point, you wonder if there might have been room for Harris or Booker if they had hung on a little bit longer. I'd be curious if either of them are thinking that right now. I have a hunch they might be. If he doesn't hold the African-American vote, I think his candidacy is over. It's that simple. It's a do-or-die thing. That's why I think it's so important that Congressman Clyburn from South Carolina, who is very, very popular in the state, is endorsing Biden on Wednesday. And Clyburn, by the way, is very close to Nancy Pelosi, and I've had the thought that could this possibly mean that Pelosi is also thinking about those down-ballot Democrats she's got to reelect the next time?
Well, and speaking about those down-ballot Democrats, how does your book factor in when we think about elections at a state or local level?
Well, you know, one of the stories we didn't talk about much at the time were how many governorships moderate to progressive Democrats picked up, where in Trump states, so that the Democrats reelected a Democratic governor in Pennsylvania, they elected a new Democratic governor in Michigan, Gretchen Whitmer, whose slogan I love. Her slogan was "Fix the damn roads," and her campaign actually was worried that people wouldn't like the dam, so they focus grouped it and tested it, and it turned out people were so angry about the conditions of the roads, they liked the slogan better with the dam in the middle of it. You know, the Democrats took Wisconsin. They also took Kansas. Kansas is a very interesting case where a very right-wing Republican, Sam Brownback, slashed taxes, slashed spending on public education, and there was a revolt. There was a revolt of the middle as well as progressives. A lot of suburban Republicans did not want school funding cut. They want their kids to go to good schools. And so a coalition in the legislature of Democrats and moderate Republicans repealed his tax cuts. And a Democrat got elected governor with the support of many leading Republicans in the state. Tom Vilsack, the former governor of Iowa and agriculture secretary, said a lot of these candidates were progressive in their approaches and moderate in temperament, and that is what a lot of voters in a lot of states were looking for. So governorships was actually one of the big success stories of 2018, although the Democrats were heartbroken that two prominent African Americans lost so narrowly, Andrew Gillum down in Florida and Stacey Abrams in Georgia.
And in those cases, the idea of structural issues, voter suppression, were brought into play there. And how does the Democratic Party, has it resolved any of those things? Eric Holder spent a lot of time in the last 4 years working on gerrymandered districts. Have we made any progress, or have the Democrats made any progress in fixing structural issues that prevent voting?
Yes, it's, you know, it's really striking. In states that are still all Republican, they have not been able to roll back some of these voter suppression measures. My favorite is the one in Texas where people could use their concealed carry license as a voter ID, but students could not use their IDs issued by a public university. You wonder, what are they trying to do there? But in states that Democrats have control, they've not only prevented voter suppression measures. They've actually increased access to the ballot. They've passed same-day voter registration. They've expanded early voting. They've done all sorts of things to make it easier to vote. And the evidence of 2018 is turnout went up a lot in those states. I think our system is particularly tough on young people because young people move around more than more settled older people. And our whole registration system requires an awful lot of civic attentiveness if you're young and you want to vote, much more than it does of older people. So in these states that have reformed their laws and increased access to the ballot, you've gotten more voters out. And so you can not only reverse these laws, but you can actually move forward with a variety of measures that a lot of states have taken.
Well, in the last couple minutes that we have, I did want to acknowledge we have some comments here saying that we're not giving enough love to Bernie in his ability to move the ticket and move the ticket forward. And what would you say to a comment like that, saying that you are not giving Bernie enough credit to bring the party forward?
Well, the case for Bernie, first of all, if I'd like Bernie's folks to read my book, because I think what they'll find is they might not agree with me on everything, but I think what they'll find is I really give Sanders a lot of credit for moving our debate in a better direction, and I am glad he's opened up space in the debate. I think the question that we got to confront, it's a practical question, is Bernie right when he says that he will attract a whole lot of new voters into the electorate? In the book, I argue that all elections are about both mobilization and persuasion, turning your people out, but also pulling people over from the other side, changing people's minds. It's possible that Bernie could have some particular appeal to working class voters. You see some of that in the polling. You certainly saw that in his victories in Michigan and Wisconsin in the last election against Hillary Clinton. But it's not clear to me yet that Bernie can indeed mobilize a vast new electorate. I think that's something he's got to prove. And you haven't seen huge turnout increases in the primaries. Indeed, in New Hampshire, turnout went up more in the areas that Klobuchar and Buttigieg carried. So I think that's what I'd ask Bernie's people to sort of pay attention to sort of see as legitimate the question of whether Bernie can or cannot mobilize voters. On the other hand, he has built, I think the thing I most admire about what he's done is his success in building this vast grassroots fundraising operation, because that is the way we're going to democratize politics, is when you can move the financing of campaigns out of the hands of very rich people and spread it across a large number of participants, as he has. That's something I want all campaigns to imitate.
Well, we'll have to leave that there. This has been City Visions for this evening. Our guest tonight was E.J. Dionne, the columnist for The Washington Post and the author of the recently published book, Code Red, How Progressives and Moderates Can Unite to Save Our Country. You can see E.J. Dionne on February 27th at 12 p.m. at the Commonwealth Club, where he will be in conversation with former Senator Barbara Boxer, and also at the Hillside Club in Berkeley at 7:30 p.m. Details are on our website. For a link to this and other City Visions shows, to let us know what you thought and about tonight's program, and to subscribe, go to our City Visions webpage on KALW.org. Our engineer this evening was David LaTulipe. Tonight's show was produced by Chris Nooney. I'm Grace Wan. Thanks for listening. Good night and have a great week.